ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ
नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
नारायणं नमस्कृत्य चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जयमुदीरये नष्टप्रायेष्वभद्रेषु नित्यं भागवत सेवया भगवत्युत्तम श्लोके भक्तिर्भवती नैष्ठिकी 24 रीडिंग फ्रॉम श्रीमद् भागवतम कैंटो 3 चैप्टर 22 द मैरिज ऑफ कर्दम मुनि एंड देवहूति टेक्स्ट 24 प्रत्ताम दुहितरम सम्राट सदृक्षाय गत व्यथः उपगुह्य च बाहुभ्याम् औत्कण्ठ्य उन्मथित आशयः वृत्तां दुहितरं सम्राट् सदृक्षाय गतव्यथः उपगुह्य च बाहुभ्याम् औत्कण्ठ्योन्मथिताशयः प्रत्तां दुहितरं सम्राट् सदृक्षाय गतव्यथः उपगुह्य च बाहुभ्याम् औत्कण्ठ्योन्मथिताशयः प्रत्तां दुहितरं सम्राट् सदृक्षाय गतव्यथः उपगुह्य च बाहुभ्याम् औत्कण्ठ्योन्मथिताशयः प्रत्ताम् हु वाज़ गिवन् दुहितरम् डॉटर् सम्राट् दि एम्परर् मनो सदृक्षाय अन्टु अ सूटबल् पर्सन् गतव्यथः relieved of his responsibility upaguhya embracing cha and bahubhyam with his two arms outkanthya unmathita ashayah having an anxious and agitated mind Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Translation. Thus relieved of his responsibility by handing over his daughter to a suitable man, Swayambhuva Mano, his mind agitated by feelings of separation, embraced his affectionate daughter with both his arms. Purport. A father always remains in anxiety until he can hand over his his grown-up daughter to a suitable boy. A father and mother's responsibility for children continues until they marry them to suitable spouses. When the father is able to perform that duty, he is relieved of his responsibility. Om Jnanatimirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurum Nilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manopishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamahyam Dadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yudhapada Kamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sakrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitantam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhanvitamscha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Krishthaya Bhutale Shri Mate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Nitinane Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Prachare Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Desha Tarine Vanchakalpatarubhyascha Kripasindubhyayevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasadi Gaurabhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Hare Krishna
Hare Krishna
Very happy to see so many devotees here this morning. Perhaps it helps that it is Saturday. But nevertheless, on a Saturday morning also, that you have come here in such large numbers is very, very encouraging. The topic that has been going on and that will continue for a while is, from the modern standpoint, a very controversial one. And one that the modern world considers extremely regressive and even oppressive, old-fashioned, out of date, etc., etc. In this particular verse we see that Svayambhuva Manu has arranged for the marriage of his daughter to a worthy spouse, Kardama Muni. His daughter's name is Devahuti. Svayambhuva Manu and his wife Shatarupa have concluded that Kardama Muni is the right choice. Devahuti is also happy, even though she is the daughter of a king, accustomed to very opulent living from the beginning. But now she has happily consented to be with a sage living in the forest. Svayambhuva Manu now is relieved of his responsibilities. He had thus far been quite anxious about the marriage of his daughter. Now that this has been accomplished, he is very relieved. And at the same time, he is about to hand over his daughter to her husband. His daughter is about to leave home to go to the home of her new husband. So he is very aggrieved, and therefore he embraces his daughter. Now, as far as these things are concerned about finding a suitable match, marrying off the daughter, I must confess it is not my area of expertise. But nevertheless, it is my lot that it has come in the verse that I am supposed to speak on today. And it is there in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So I will try to share a few thoughts on this very controversial topic, being careful with every word I speak because it is on the internet. And these are topics that are likely to become very controversial and people will make all sorts of accusations and allegations. I must also confess that within the movement of devotees there may be slight variations of opinions on topics such as these. The basic principles of Krishna consciousness are of course very clear to devotees. Where the differences arise sometimes is in their practical applications, and especially when it comes to cultural issues and social issues. The application of eternal time-tested principles to the modern situation, that is where differences of opinion may arise. Now, in the series of verses that we are seeing here, there are many phrases that come to mind in relation to the cultural aspect of life depicted in the scriptures like the Srimad Bhagavatam. One is arranged marriage. Now, in the Western world, the term arranged marriage is not a very popular term. It is considered something not just regressive, but it is considered something that is, positively it could be almost illegal, because it's assumed that an arranged marriage is something that is forced upon a girl, something that she doesn't like. And indeed, if it is like that, that is not proper. And because it may be happening sometimes, so there may be some grounds for the modern world to feel some angst about it. But that is not how it is supposed to be. It's not that, generally speaking, the parents would force the girl to get married to somebody against her will. Even though, as I said, it may sometimes happen, and it has happened in the past. But generally, the system is that the parents would be very anxious that the daughter was happy at the choice. We see here in this case that Devahuti was happy with the choice that her parents had made about her to be husband. It wasn't something that was simply forced upon her. So there is the concept of arranged marriage, and versus, let us say, the modern system of, what do we call it? Love marriage? Or whatever you call it. So the traditional system versus the modern system. Now, there are disasters in both. There are good examples in both. But if you look at the whole thing from a statistical point of view, or if you look at it from a cultural context, there are many things to say about the arranged marriage as well. Although we do have to, to temper it with the modern situation. You can't do a cut and paste job, yes, with the traditional Vedic culture, and you try to transplant it into the modern day soil, social soil. It's not going to work, and it doesn't work. At the same time, there are certain things that we have to try to understand in terms of the basic principles. What are the basic principles that are enshrined in the Vedic culture? The details may change. Now, the principle of an arranged marriage is one of the principles of the Vedic culture. However, it needs to be pointed out that that was not the only form of marriage in the Vedic culture. We have numerous examples, especially among the Kshatriya communities, where marriage took place by the choice of the girl. We had the Swayamvara ceremony. For example, Draupadi Swayamvara, where Draupadi's father, King Drupad, arranged for a competition. And he wanted to ensure that only the most qualified prince or king would be the husband of his daughter. And the competition was extremely tough. And most people, most of the princes who came there, or the kings who came there, were unable to fulfill even the very preliminary requirements. Can someone just look after the children, please? Yeah. And whereas Arjuna came forward, and Arjuna was able to fulfill all the requirements, and he eventually married Draupadi. And Draupadi was very happy to marry him. And even as recently as 500 or 600 years ago, there are famous historical incidents where princes, princesses, they would go around in an assembly of suitors, and they would go with a garland, and they would look at the prospective candidates, and whoever they found suitable, she would put the garland around him and the marriage. And all the other men would be, you can imagine what was their condition. They were not quite cheerful when that happened. And then sometimes there would be wars that would break out. Because some other princes, they wanted to marry this princess. And she married somebody whom they did not like. And the battle would break out. In fact, so this was very common over there at that time among the Kshatriyas. Sometimes amongst the Kshatriyas there was a kind of wedding where the princess was abducted. If she was going to be married against her wishes, then the suitor would come and forcibly, physically, in movie style, abduct her on his horse or chariot and go away. And who exemplified this? None other than the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. When Rukmini Devi was to be married off to Shishupal, as per the wishes of her brother Rukmi, then her father, King Bhishmaka, was not so happy with it, but he went along with his son. But Rukmini wasn't happy. She had set her mind on Krishna. So she wanted to marry Krishna. So she had earlier sent off a letter through a trusted Brahmana to Krishna in Dwarka. Please come and rescue me and marry me, because my father and brother want me to marry Shishupal and I don't want to marry him at all. And then Krishna and Balaram, they sat together and made a plan, and Krishna immediately set out for Kaundinyapur, the place of Rukmini. And Balaram set out with the army, coming at the back, just a little bit behind. And when Krishna reached there, Rukmini Devi was going through the motions of the traditions that members of her family went through before marriage. They went to a certain temple and then they were coming out, and that was the point which was the most suitable for being abducted by Krishna. So Krishna came along in the chariot and swooped her off the ground and placed her in the chariot, and he took her off right in the front of all the other princes and the kings who were standing there. And there was a hue and cry, and all these princes started chasing Krishna. By the time Krishna was on his chariot and taking Rukmini away, Balaram arrived with his army. And there was a huge battle, and all these kings were either killed or defeated. And even Rukmi, he had taken a vow that he would, foolishly he took a vow, that he would bring back Rukmini from Krishna or else. And then finally, Krishna and Balaram, they humiliated him and sent him back, but with his life. So in any case, Rukmini Devi then became Krishna's husband. Wife, I beg your pardon. Nowadays, the modern day and age, everything is confused. Who's his husband? Who's whose wife? You know, it's a very confused modern scenario. So, being living and hearing about modern day problems, you see the identities of, you know, the two get all confused and mixed up. That is one of the problems of the modern day living. Because I haven't prepared for this class, I'm thinking on my feet, so to speak. So there are these different types of marriages that are found in the Vedic scriptures. So one in which the bride personally selects her husband from amongst a variety of suitors. Second, in which the bride is forcefully abducted, sometimes against her will, but mostly, you know, in keeping with her will. We have the cases of Amba, Ambalika, Ambika, whom Bhishma abducted forcefully. Two of the sisters were happy, but the third wasn't. So Bhishma then returned her back. She said, I've already given my heart to someone else, so I can't marry the princess that you have chosen for me. So he took her back. And he took her back to her home. But then the person whom she had set her heart on refused to marry her, saying, Bhishma has touched your hands, so I cannot marry you. So even touching hands was something very serious. So if you touched a lady's hand, it was meant that you were going to marry her. Nowadays, we are so far removed from that culture. Everybody, they shake hands, they do everything, right? So he said, Bhishma has touched your hands, you should be married to him. So she came back to Bhishma and said, now Shalva won't marry me, so you must marry me. So he said, no, I have taken a vow in front of Radha Vallabha that I will never marry. So I'm a lifelong brahmachari, so I'm sorry, I can't marry you. So then she went back to Parashuram, who was the military guru of Bhishma. And Parashuram said, what? That's not right. He must marry you. So he spoke to Bhishma and said, Bhishma, you must marry her. The damsel in distress, you must help. And he said, no, I've taken my vow. I cannot do that. And then there was a battle between Parashuram and Bhishma that lasted for a long time. And eventually they were evenly matched, and then there was a draw. And then Parashuram told her, I'm sorry, I've done my bit. I can't make him change his mind. And then she became very upset, actually. And she took a vow. She ended her life and took a vow that I shall be the cause of, you know, the death of this family. Anyway, so that's the whole story. So there are also situations where there was forceful abductions. Many times the kings would they would have to accept requests from sages and so on and so forth for the marriage of their daughters. In the case of Saubhari Muni, we see that he was meditating under the water for a long time, and after having seen two fish mating, he decided to get married. He came out, but his body was completely wrinkled because of being under the water for so many years. And he approached King Mandhata, who had 50 daughters. And when he approached the king for marriage, the king was very nervous about it, because on one hand, he didn't want to give his daughters in marriage to such a person who looked so ugly and he was so old. And he was a sage. He didn't have a place to live, he didn't have anything. And on the other hand, he was afraid that if he should say no, then he might curse the king and his daughters. So very diplomatically he said, you know, oh sage, I can't force my daughters. So if they're happy to marry you, I have no problem. So he passed the buck. And the daughters took one look at him and said, you know, sorry, we can't, you know. So then somebody said, oh, is that it? So by his mystic power, he transformed himself into a young, handsome man. And he came back, and all the 50 daughters wanted to marry him, which he did also. So anyway, there are numerous instances of this sort. There are some instances where the Lord personally intervenes and decides to marry somebody after somebody. And that happens all the time. We see in the case, there was a famous story, and I'll tell you the name of the person after I finish the story, where there was this young man who was quite devoted to Lord Krishna and specifically to Lord Jagannath. And one day there was a Brahmin who came and said, look, I have my daughter here and you must marry her. He said, no, thank you, I don't want to marry, I want to remain a brahmachari. I want to be single and I want to dedicate myself to devotional service to Krishna. He said, but no, Lord Jagannath has appeared in my dream and told me that I have to hand over my daughter to you, and that's it. So he left his daughter in his house and just walked out. And this young man was saying, hey, wait a minute, what is this here now? What's going on here? Look, this is not for me. You can't do this. You can't just leave her here and just go away like this. And he said, I don't know. It's between you and Jagannath. I've got my orders from Jagannath and that's it. And I'm going to do it. So he left his daughter there and went away. And then this young man was thinking, my word, what to do now? So then he agreed. He said, okay, if it's like Jagannath's wish, what can I do? So then he married her because the father just walked away, having done his duty. So then eventually he married her. And then there was a child. At the same time he said, look, you know, I want to take sannyas. But now, you know, suddenly you come here into my life like this. Now, you know, what do I do? He said, okay, after the child is born, then I'll leave, okay? So she said, all right. So then the child was born, but as it so happened, in childbirth, the mother died. So now he was really wondering, what should I do? Now I'm supposed to leave home, and here I have this child with me, and what can I do? So then he was thinking, he was looking and looking, wondering. And at that time, there was a little spider, and not a spider, a lizard, who fell from the roof onto the ground. It was a baby lizard. And the lizard then was looking around here and there. He saw a little insect in the corner, just went up, opened its mouth, stuck out its tongue, pulled the insect in and sucked it into its mouth. And this man was looking at this lizard, who was just newly born, and thinking, how did this baby lizard know what to eat, what not to eat, how to eat, what is food, what is not food? Newly born, didn't go to any school, didn't have any training, it was nothing. How did he know what to do? So he concluded that the Supreme Lord is arranging for everybody's maintenance. So even this child's maintenance will be arranged by the Lord. So he understood and walked out. The Lord will take care. Now, a word of caution. Many, many words of caution. You can't imitate or even dream of imitating such a thing. These are some extraordinary cases which are just there in history. It happens in the case of exceptional personalities, but we dare not imitate such a thing. And eventually, of course, that man was Sridhar Swami, the great commentator on the Srimad Bhagavatam. So there are a variety of marriages that have happened in the Vedic culture. And there are some in which the ladies have got married, the daughters have got married to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Amongst the Alvars of the Sri Sampradaya of South India, the word Alvar means intoxicated, and it basically means intoxicated with love of Godhead. So there are these 12 great devotees of Krishna who lived at very different times in South India. One of them was a king, Kulashekhar, we've heard his name, who was the author of the Mukundamala Stotra. Another one was a lady, Andal. She was one of the 12 Alvars, and her father, Peri Alvar, was also one of the Alvars. So Peri Alvar's service in the holy place of Sri Rangam to Lord Ranganath was that he was looking after a garden. He would grow flowers, pluck the flowers, string them into garlands, and offer the garlands to the deity. That was his main service. And every day he would do that. So the garlands that the Lord wore, the deity wore, were made by devotees like him. Now one day, when Peri Alvar came in, he had gone out for some errand, he came back to his home, and he saw that his young daughter, she was very young, that she had taken the garland that was meant for the deity, and she had worn it around her neck, and was admiring herself in the mirror. So naturally the father was scandalized. He said, "What on earth are you doing? This is meant for the deity. This is meant for Krishna. You can't offer things that you have worn to Krishna. We have to take Krishna's prasadam, not the other way around. Not that you should wear something and then offer it to Krishna. So have you been doing this all these days? Oh my God, what an offense I have done. That means every day I have been offering garlands to Krishna that have been worn by you." So he was really aghast. And then he decided that he wouldn't offer that garland, naturally, because his daughter had already worn it. And then the pujari came running the next evening and he said, what are you doing, Peri Alvar, what are you doing? He said, I'm sorry, this garland was worn by my daughter. No. He said, the Lord appeared in my dream and chastised me and told me to chastise you. He told me that he wants only the garlands that are worn by your daughter first. Only then will he accept it. Otherwise he won't accept those garlands. So Peri Alvar was really struck with wonder. He said, what kind of girl is this? And the Lord wants to wear garlands that she has worn first. And then that tradition started. And then she grew up a little more. And she was still very, very young, of course. And in those days, girls and boys would get married much younger. And that is the next topic we come to after arranged marriage. The next unpopular topic. And she, the time came for her marriage. And naturally, as a father, he became very anxious to find a boy for her, and he wasn't able to, for the simple reason that Andal wanted to marry only Krishna. So he said, "Look, I mean, you can become his devotee, that's great, but you know, you have to marry, you know. You can't say you want to marry the deity." She insisted, "No, I'll marry only him, nobody else." So he was really in a fix what to do. So then finally, the Lord himself spoke to his pujaris and said, "No, I'll marry her. And she will not marry anybody else." So there was a whole big ceremony. She was taken in a palanquin in grand style, in a grand procession, with musical instruments and everything. And they arrived at the temple. And then she was escorted into the altar and the door closed behind. And after that, when the door opened, then she had disappeared. So that is how the traditional stories of the Sri Sampradaya go. So there are instances like this also. So as far as arranged marriages, as I said at the beginning, it's not that everything is hunky-dory, that everything was fine. There have always been problems in marriage. The institution of marriage is such that there are issues, what to do. The other day I was just saying a little joke that there was a young man who approached a sadhu, approached a holy man and said, you know, can you please help me? I have so many problems in my family, you know. I really don't know what to do about them. Can you help me? So the sadhu, the holy man, looked very kindly at the young man and said, son, if these things had a solution, do you think I would have been a sadhu? Well, you know, that's life, you know, what can you do? So, yes, even in the earlier days in traditional life, and there were problems. Mother-in-law, daughter-in-law issues are very famous in India. In-laws are often called outlaws and so on and so forth. So much humor and banter is going on about these things. But nevertheless, despite the issues in tradition, not that there were no problems or differences or incompatibility even, but there were many, many benefits as well. Marriages sustained, and people understood that life was meant for a higher purpose. Life was not meant merely for some immediate selfish gratification. And because of a higher purpose in mind, they were not driven only by superficial considerations of bodily attraction or even of immediate any kind of selfish interest. So even though there were problems in marriage in many cases, they would just take it in their stride and they would go on. Because they knew that they had to live for a larger cause. There was God ultimately that they had to live for. And there were children, there was society, they had so many other responsibilities. It was not just that I am the center of the universe, and therefore if something is unpleasant for me, I will just do whatever I like to make my life more pleasant. So there was that spirit of sacrifice, that spirit of understanding something higher, something deeper. Whereas today, as the years go by, we see people are becoming more and more self-centered, more and more independent-minded, more and more concerned about their immediate pleasure and pain, not willing to consider or accommodate the concerns of others in their life. And they say, fine, you want your life, but you be separate. I'm going to be separate. You do your thing, I'm going to do my thing. So there's no emphasis on accommodation or adjustments, on tolerance, which is very much an important element of any relationship, whether it's a relationship of marriage or anywhere else. So these things are rapidly diminishing now, with the result that relationships have become very dysfunctional in the modern day and age. And the statistics for divorce, I don't have them at my fingertips. Is it possible to get something on your Google?
Yeah.
Some statistics on divorces? It's astonishing. There are people get into marriages and then break up. And the number of marriages, second, third, fourth, fifth. And famous movie stars, they almost get into double digits. And then people finally come to a point when they just give up. Consider no point in marriage. So now they jettison the whole idea of the institution of marriage. They say no point in having it. So the institution of marriage is practically crumbled in the whole world now. In the Western, wherever I travel, whether it's Russia or it's America, I don't know, Australia as well to a large degree, and many places, there's hardly anything called marriage left. I mean, there is, but the proportion has drastically dropped compared to the early years. Most people are single or are just living together without marriage because they don't want to go through the trauma of separation, which they know will eventually happen in a short time. So why go through the whole process of divorce and this and that and all the legal implications that go on with it? It's just, why should we do that? To just live together? Oh, divorce statistics by country.
Okay. What does that mean? Crude marriage rate, 8.9, crude divorce. What is this divorce rate? 1.7.
No, can you give me something that I can understand, statistics?
So, this is a phenomenon of our modern times that we need to understand. It's not a question of moralizing. It's just a question of accepting a way of life that has consequences. Are we as a society ready to have the consequences of our actions? Many times when you speak of traditional values, especially in terms of social life, domestic life, then there are objections raised as to about how we are moralizing and imposing. It's not a question of imposition. It's a question of trying to understand the consequences of our actions. Now, if you have the modern system where everybody whimsically chooses their own partner just because of some superficial attraction, it may often even be sexual attraction, and even if it's not, it's some degree of superficial attraction or attachment that comes up. But because there is no deeper substance in the relationship, there is no deep culture within which that relationship exists. So whenever there is a difficulty, then immediately everything just collapses and crumbles. So in the earlier days, there was also, especially among some communities, the principle of marriage on the basis of attraction. All right, that's something that's natural in this world. It happens. But because of the cultural context, and because of a higher understanding of the goal of life, that was not the only thing. Because of that larger cultural base and the philosophical understanding of life, that relationship sustained despite the marriage having taken place on the basis of some kind of attraction. But today, there's only that attraction and there is no background culture. There is no higher philosophical understanding of the goal of life. So therefore, when that attraction is disrupted to some degree, and for whatever reason, everything immediately crumbles. And therefore you have a very, very unstable situation. You have people becoming very insecure in the relationships because you don't know when it's going to break up. It could happen any time. And we have a situation where now people are so relieved when that relationship is over that they throw a party. It's quite sad in a sense, because there are divorce parties going on. Just, you know, there were times when you threw a party because you got married. It was a marriage party, but now they have parties for divorce. It's happening. Am I right? Is it happening?
Yes.
It happens. Because they're so relieved that they are through with this. So, is this the kind of world where we want to live, where there's no stability in relationships? Where there is complete insecurity and uncertainty about where your relationship is going tomorrow? I quote this often. There was some survey done amongst young people, you know, all over the world in different countries. And they were asked what was the biggest problem that they faced in their life. I don't remember the whole finding, but I just remember the findings in two countries, Germany and Australia. In Germany, the response was that the biggest problem the young people face is loneliness. And in Australia, the biggest problem they found was a fear of losing their partner. Now, when there is uncertainty about such fundamental things in your life, how can there be happiness? So what we need today is a re-look at our so-called liberal values. We also need a re-look at our traditional values. What we need to do today is to take the best from both worlds.
we need to take the best from our traditional values. At the same time, we should be careful to not do a cut and paste job. We should try to see that people are happy, they give a certain degree of freedom and so on and so forth. It has to be done in a little bit of a broad-minded way, in a way of considerate way, in a sensitive way, making sure that things are not forcibly imposed. But slowly that atmosphere, that culture has to be built so that the elements of that traditional culture can be introduced and can be adapted and adjusted to the modern situation. It's not just a question of transplanting. So yes, there can be arranged marriage, but in that arranged marriage, if you leave scope for the boy and girl to have some kind of meeting so they have a liking, and then the marriage goes on, you have a combination of the two. Many of our devotees, our grihastha devotees in different temples, they take the responsibility to get the young men and women in their community of devotees married. It's a big responsibility. Because if the girls and boys want to marry, then they have to look within the community of devotees. They don't want to get married to non-devotees. That would be certainly a disaster for their spiritual life and for their personal life as well. So the devotee community, the grihasthas, must come together to help those who wish to get married. And also to help those who are already married who are facing some difficulties. And that happens all the time. So our grihastha should come together. And in many of our temples, what the grihasthas do is, they try to arrange. At the same time, they adapt the situation to the mentalities of modern day youths and ask them to meet and see if they can match together, if they feel themselves comfortable and so on. It's not something that's just forcibly imposed. So arranged marriages in the modern context don't have to be things which are forcibly imposed. But it can be a combination where you arrange something and then they see if things work out, they meet each other for some time, and they talk, they find out, they exchange notes and so on, and if both are comfortable, then they say yes, then the elders are there, the parents are there, if the parents are around, and if they get the blessings of the senior devotees, and they go ahead. So here is a practical way in which you can have a combination of the two, where you have an arranged setup, but not in a repressive or oppressive way, but in a sensitive way, taking into account the opinions and the feelings of the candidates involved. It's not a very difficult thing to do. On the other hand, if you have a situation where the young people have to just look out for their own partner, that's not a healthy situation. So that's a situation where everyone is insecure and it just doesn't make for a good, healthy society. So here we find also, in addition to Devahuti being married off, that she was quite young when she was married off. And this is another very controversial topic of child marriage. Now, we must take the principle of it, not the actual age of child marriage. What is the principle? Just as the principle of the arranged marriage is that the elder should come in the picture and that they should try to arrange something that is harmonious, in which many factors are considered, give the boy and the girl a kind of freedom to see whether they can adjust to each other. And under the guidance of the elders, everything is done nicely. So that's the principle. Similarly, the principle of child marriage, let's consider that. It's not just that in the modern times you should get boys and girls married when they're 10 years old or 11 years old. No. The principle that they should marry early. There is sense in that. By early, I don't mean 10 and 11, obviously. But I mean that reasonably early. We are all living in different countries, so let's follow the law of the land. Yes, I don't advocate that we should break the law of the land. Every country has its laws about the minimum age for marriage. Fine. But when people say that this, you know, marrying young business is the whole thing is regressive, and you know, you should wait till you're much older and so on and so forth. Let's consider. In the traditional times, you had boys and girls who married young. And today, those who oppose that in the name of freedom, they forget. Can I have some statistics of,
yeah.
I mentioned to you some,
yeah.
when I was in the car, I just told him, give me some statistics of teenage pregnancies. Yes? No, what is it?
Per thousand, it's a percentage of. So for South Korea, per thousand, there are 1.8 women who are teenage pregnant.
Okay. So in terms of the numbers of people, is there something in terms of numbers?
Yeah,
in terms, no, numbers, actually numbers of teenage pregnancies. The numbers of teenage pregnancies today can be staggering, shocking, starting from 12, 13, 14. Now, what would you prefer? Would you prefer that girls get married early, or you prefer that they should get pregnant from unscrupulous boys, you know, at the age of 12, 13, 14, 15, remain unmarried, have many such pregnancies? That's what our modern day life is. I mean, we have to face the harsh reality of the world we live in. We espouse all these values of saying we should be free and everything, and we denounce everything traditional as being regressive and oppressive. And here we have a situation where you have thousands upon thousands of young girls, 12, 13 years of age, getting pregnant, regularly using contraception and so on and so forth. So what kind of liberalism or open atmosphere is this? Which do we prefer? And then they have abortions and so on and so forth. Which country, anyway? Sorry, I haven't prepared, otherwise I could have come with some well-prepared statistics, but anyway, so we won't get into the statistics. Suffice it to say that a very large number of young girls today in most countries, in many countries of the world today. So you talk of child, you know, you talk so heavily against child marriage, but you don't discourage, because you can't do anything about it. You can't do anything about 12-year-old girls getting pregnant in large numbers. You have no choice about it, because that's the lifestyle that you have adopted. That is the kind of value system you have adopted. That's the kind of culture and the philosophy of society that exists. So how are you going to stop the young boys and the young girls from doing this? So, yes, we don't say that you should marry them off at 12 and 13, but we say let them, don't unnecessarily delay in the name of career and progress and, you know, so on and so forth, of being independent. What happens in a society in which the institution of marriage crumbles? Nowadays, people don't even want to get married, or they don't want to have children even if they're married, or even if they are partners, they don't want children, because it means there is a big headache. Because looking after children is not easy. It's a big austerity. It's a big sacrifice. It takes so much pain and trouble to look after children. So, because people today are becoming so independent-minded, so self-centered, they don't want to take on pain for anything else, anyone else, fewer and fewer people now want children. Plus, they have other ambitions. They have their career, they have so many other desires. They feel that having children will impede the fulfillment of their desires. And so, we have a plummeting birth rate. We have a rising proportion of elderly people. And this is a big social problem. Pensions. And where is the money going to come from? So the Western governments the liberal socialist governments have this kind of problem. How to pay off the pensions? How to look after the old people? There's nobody to look after the older people. So there's a host of fallouts or results or consequences of the kind of values that we are espousing today. I read an interesting, or heard an interesting lecture by a professor, not a devotee, a professor in America. He was a professor of physics, and this was on future, on futuristics or something like that. And he was talking about the science of robotics. And he said, you know, robots, now when you speak of robots, generally you think of, say, robots being used for industrial applications or maybe even in warfare. But he said, do you know the country which has the number one progress in robotics? He said, Japan. And he said, do you know why they have the largest or the biggest advancement in the field of robotics? Why they need robotics more? What do you think? Why does Japan need robotics so much? They need robots. Why? To take care of the elderly. Because there's no one to take care of the elderly. So they're developing robots who can stay in the homes of these elders and give them their medicines on time or cook for them or whatever it is that they are programmed to do. Because there is no such system left. Traditionally, the system is that you had an institution of marriage, you had a family culture, the youngsters looked after the elders, and that's how it went and sustained for thousands of years. And now in 50 years, in 70 years, 100 years, we've demolished that whole edifice of social care. And the elderly are left in the lurch. There's nobody to look after them now. The children are too busy with their jobs. They're too busy struggling with their careers, wanting to make it big because of their ambitions, or maybe because of financial considerations, or merely because they just don't have that kind of selflessness to look after their elderly parents. So what happens? What happens to the elderly? And what happens to the children? Who is going to look after them now? So now that the children are there, even for those few who have children, both parents go out to work, so there you are, send them to the daycare. And once they're in the daycare, they get the sanskars of the people who are managing the daycare. So the upbringing of your children in this day of outsourcing is also outsourced. There's a hue and cry about outsourcing, you know, jobs to China and India and Vietnam and Taiwan and whatever else. But people don't realize they're outsourcing the most important thing, the consciousness of their children. They're outsourcing the consciousness of their children to people who look after the daycare homes. And whatever, babysitters or whoever else, or to the television or to the school. They abdicate their own responsibility for giving the proper consciousness of some scars to their children. So how do we expect that we're going to have a society in which the young children are going to be brought up emotionally properly nourished, spiritually cultivated? So the children grow up being psychologically disturbed because of the relationships being dysfunctional, and the breakups in the marriage, it has severe emotional effects on the children. They grow up with warped psychologies, and therefore they are not able to have relationships with others because of their childhood experiences, and it goes on and on and on. This is the society we are talking about. These are the kind of practices and mindsets that we are perpetuating with our so-called modern values. To be sure, there are some good things in the modern values, the system, that we should take into account, yes. We shouldn't be just fanatics and just, because something is modern, just reject it. No. So we have to appreciate the essential principles of the traditional life. Consider carefully what's valuable in the modern life and integrate the two in a very wholesome amalgam. Very carefully considering how it's going to impact ultimately our Krishna consciousness and the Krishna consciousness of the world at large. being willing to make adjustments and being a little flexible here and there. So whether it's arranged marriage, whether it's marriage in a younger age, and so on, these are things we have to carefully consider. The older the age becomes, the more difficult it is for people to adjust with another person. The younger you are, the more open-minded you are, the more flexible you are, you can get adjusted with another person more easily. But the older you become, you get set and rigid in your views. And it's very hard to adjust to another person. So therefore, it's hard for people to settle down together. Not that it's not possible, but it's just harder. And then the children, they are born when the parents are much older. And therefore, by the time the children have grown up, the parents are well into their 60s or something, because now they have to, you know, pay for the bills of the children, so they have to work much later. They can't renounce the world and dedicate their time to Krishna's service because they still have to make money for their children. There's a host of consequences like that. And even medically, it's not wise to delay it so much. Childbirth is something that's better done when one is younger than older. So there's a whole host of consequences that people have to look into before just writing off the traditional culture as being regressive and arranged marriage as being something devilish or demoniac. We have to reconsider these things in a very harmonious way, in a very careful and mature way, accepting principles from the traditional Vedic culture and also accepting those things that are helpful from the modern world. Of course, the topic is endless, but I thought I'd just share a few thoughts, being inspired by the example of Swayambhuva Manu and Kardama Muni and Devahuti and Srila Prabhupada's thoughts over here. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. I think it's 9 o'clock, so we will have time for questions. So we'll stop here. Okay, you insist on a question. We have time? Are you sure? But people are hungry. Prasad is not ready. Okay, so it's not my fault. Okay? And today, Saturday, is not a working day. So if any of you have your guns and your swords out, you know, you can. Yes. Prabhu's making a very important point. He did some research on this topic, and as per the latest surveys, the divorce rate for the normal, whatever in the modern world, marriages is 55% divorce rate, and for the so-called arranged marriages it is 5%. Is there a difference? Only 50% difference. Thank you. That speaks volumes, isn't it? Speaks volumes. So there you are. Yes.
Maharaj, what is the root cause of changing our consciousness in this area?
What is the root cause of changing of the why the world has changed its consciousness? So why has this change happened in the thinking of society? At one level you could say it's because it's Kali Yuga, because these things are meant to happen in Kali Yuga. Secondly, of course, we can say it's because of a lack of Krishna consciousness, a lack of understanding of proper traditional principles, because of an onset of materialism, very strong materialism coming in the form of so many other isms. science, technology, you know, everything else. So a philosophy comes through all of this. So it's because materialism has caught on in such a big way that it's sweeping aside everything that is spiritual or religious or traditional. Right? Any other comments or questions? Yes.
Maharaj, you were talking about the example of Sridhar Swami, and we also see in this particular example that Kardamuni has laid a condition, and he implements that also, that as soon as children are born, I'm going to leave house and take sannyas. So it is almost like Devahuti, like one more person was discussing this with me, it is almost like Devahuti had to be a single man. So at what age did Kardamuni?
Okay, so the question is that Kardamumuni also put a condition that he would leave after the son was born, and then the marriage had to be arranged of the daughters and so on. Yes, the daughters were arranged, the marriage of the daughters was arranged by, they were all married off, and Kapila left only when he was, Kardama left, yes, but then she was under the care of her son, Kapila. So she was not left to herself, to fend for herself. So Kapiladeva was there, even as she was getting older. So she was under care, there was protection, there was security there. So similarly in the modern day and age, there is a system. The traditional system had a support base, it had a network that would support people who became elderly. Even if they didn't have sons or, you know, like that, there was a system where a larger social structure would support you. But today we don't have that, so everything comes on the government. So the government has to take the responsibility to look after everybody. Something that was supposed to be done by the family is now being outsourced to the government. Because the individuals don't want to do it, so they put it on the government. You have to look after our parents. I can't look after my parents, so you look after them. You pass the buck to the society, to the government. And then we are all paying for that, all of taxpayers. I don't pay taxes, so... So those who pay taxes, you're paying taxes for everybody's passing the buck. So this is the situation. We don't want to take responsibility for anything. We just want to pass the buck, let others take the responsibility, let the government take the responsibility. I may be willing to pay a little money as well, but don't ask me for anything more than money. I will just do what I like. I want to lead my independent life. I want to, you know, enjoy life the way I want to. I don't want to be burdened with extra responsibilities. Parents? Oh my God, no, that's too much for me. And the parents themselves say, by the time you're 14, 15, out. You should be out of the house. You're too much botheration because you're creating too much scandal anyway. Just go out and you just do whatever you need to do. You live your own life independently. So even if the children want to be with the parents will say, now you just go. So these are the awkward situations in which we have placed ourselves now. So we have to think, is this the kind of society we want? Rather than just simply demonizing traditional values and using adjectives like regressive and oppressive and so on, we should consider where we are taking our society and whether this is something that we want or not. Are we happy with this? Are we happy with the way our elderly people are in the world today? All living in old age homes, those who can afford it, and those who can't afford it. What about them? Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. I hope there's not going to be much flack from the internet coming for this lecture anyway. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.